Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Erwin Chemerinsky, who's the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
And Caitlin Halligan, who's a prominent New York lawyer, she has been rejected for a second time. She was nominated by President Obama to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And they simply wouldn't. She got a 51-41 vote, but that's well short of the filibuster. That's the threshold that the Republicans is now requiring. Well, first of all, what strikes me as being incredibly important about this, isn't this the same court, the key court that feeds cases to the Supreme Court? And indeed, many of its members go on to sit on the Supreme Court. And didn't this court recently strike down President Obama's recess appointments?
Yes, and answered all the questions you just posed. The D.C. Circuit is a particularly important court because it reviews what the administrative agencies do in Washington, often reviews what the executive branch of government does. Many of the judges in the D.C. Circuit have gone on to the Supreme Court. Antonin Scalia, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Clarence Thomas, and most recently John Roberts were all judges on the D.C. Circuit before going on to the United States Supreme Court. And finally, it is this court that handed down the astounding ruling that a president can fill vacancies through recess appointments only if the vacancy occurs during that congressional recess. That goes against 200 years of practice. In fact, Earl Warren, William Brennan, Potter Stewart were all recess appointments that would have been illegitimate under the D.C. Circuit approach.
Well, didn't President Obama nominate Caitlin Halligan for the seat vacated by the current Chief Justice Roberts?
That's correct. Remember, John Roberts went on the Supreme Court in 2005. This seat has not been filled, and we're 2013. The Republicans filibustered Caitlin Halligan during the prior Obama term and did so again yesterday. And there's only one explanation for why they did this. And that's that the National Rifle Association strongly opposed her confirmation. She had participated in a civil suit against gun manufacturers, and as a result, the NRA deemed her unacceptable. There is nothing in her background other than that that causes anyone to question her being on the court. No one, not even the senators who filibuster, questioned her qualifications or her competence.
But surely, Erwin Chemerinsky, the fact that the seat that she was nominated for, and this is the second time she's been filibustered by the Republicans, it's been vacant since 2005 when John Roberts moved to the Supreme Court, and now, what is it now, 8 years later, it's still vacant. What is the overall backlog of President Obama's judicial appointments? Because my sense is that this is a part of the inherent strategy on the part of the Republicans, why they require filibusters, whether the excuse is the NRA or whatever they come up with. That's not the point, surely. This is a way to slant the judiciary in their direction.
You're absolutely right. The United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit is very closely balanced between conservatives and liberals who are on active status. The Republicans don't want to give a Democratic president another seat on the D.C. Circuit, so they're simply holding it up. The irony here is when the Democrats were filibustering President George W. Bush's nominees, the Republicans threatened the nuclear option and said they would eliminate the filibuster entirely. The Democrats caved. Among other things, they confirmed a very conservative judge, Janice Rogers Brown, for that court. And the Democrats agreed not to use the filibuster other than exceptional circumstances. However, now what you're seeing is the Republicans are aggressively filibustering President Obama's picks, including for the D.C. Circuit.
So what does that say about the Democrats then? Why are they so supine?
I wish I had the answer to why the Democrats won't do or at least threaten what the Republicans did to get their judicial nominees through. The Republicans said to the Democrats, if you keep filibustering our picks, we'll just eliminate the filibuster, the nuclear option. And the Democrats caved. Why don't the Democrats threaten the same thing as to the Republicans?
Well, I think there was at least a movement on the part of some of the younger Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate. In fact, that was the first order of business after the recent election when they came back into the Senate. And they were basically the older guard, the Harry Reids, essentially said they'll have filibuster reform without the nuclear option. And look where we are.
And I hope that the Democrats will reconsider that. I think there are many ways of changing the filibuster, but I think what we have now is just unacceptable. The Republicans wouldn't stand for it when there's a Republican president. The Democrats shouldn't stand for somebody like Caitlin Halligan with impeccable credentials being blocked now.
So what are you hearing from the White House, Erwin Chemerinsky, in terms of what their next move is? This is, after all, the second time this qualified judge has been filibustered by the Republicans, and this is a key court, as we mentioned, and the seat has been vacant now for the last 8 years. I believe there are other seats on this court, aren't there, that are vacant as well? In other words,
there are other vacancies, and other superbly qualified individuals have been filibustered. Take Goodwin Liu, who's a professor at the University of California Berkeley School of Law, who was nominated by President Obama for the Ninth Circuit. He was filibustered, and then Governor Jerry Brown put him on the California Supreme Court, where he sits today. There were more filibusters during President Obama's first term than ever before in American history. And I favor careful deliberation, but not obstructionism like this.
Well, ironically, of course, they've just had a filibuster, a real filibuster, going back to the movie Mr. Smith Comes to Washington, involving Rand Paul and a few other Republican senators and one Democrat, Ron Wyden, joined in. But my understanding of that was largely theatrical, that the objections that Rand Paul had already previously been dealt with, and subsequently he's been given another letter from the White House saying that there's really no substance to his objections. And even the Wall Street Journal editorial came out with a stinging rebuke of Rand Paul, as did Senator John McCain on the floor of the Senate today. So it's a bit odd, isn't it, that you actually have a filibuster that's a storm in a teacup, but you have these real filibusters that have real consequences, and they've been going on for a long time.
The Senate rules were changed to allow what we would think of as a virtual filibuster. If a senator indicates that he or she is going to filibuster, then unless there's 60 votes to bring the matter to a vote, it doesn't come for a vote. So that's why you don't usually see the filibuster where a member of the Senate stands on the floor for 13 hours. Rand Paul yesterday did that old-time, as you say, Mr. Smith goes to Washington type filibuster. But those are rare. What the Senate has done is evolved to a body where you need 60 votes to pass something. That's inconsistent with the Constitution that says majority rule, and the Constitution specifies when it wants it to have to be more than that in a Senate or a House vote.
So just back to I know I threw a whole bunch of questions at you, Erwin, but what is President Obama going to do now? This is his appointment. It's the second time. She's obviously highly qualified, and there are other open seats on this very key court as well. He's basically, there's no way in the world that he does not recognize that this is a slap in the face to him and that this situation is absolutely unsupportable.
I don't know what President Obama is going to do. His administration hasn't said. With regard to Goodwin Liu, he withdrew his nomination and President Obama appointed someone else. It may be that President Obama and Caitlin Halligan will give up. There were only 51 votes yesterday to end the filibuster, and President Obama will then just move on to a different nominee. But it is very troubling to me that somebody with impeccable qualifications could be blocked, and not because of anything about what she's done in her life, nothing about what she said. It's entirely because she participated in a civil suit against gun companies. That's the only thing that anyone can identify as to why she was filibustered, that the NRA very strongly opposes because of that. And to me, that's tremendously troubling.
But didn't we start out earlier in the Obama administration with Dawn Johnson being blocked? And I've interviewed her before, and she seems like an extremely qualified jurist.
Dawn is a professor at Indiana University. She had previously worked in the Office of Legal Counsel. She was nominated by President Obama to be the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel. She was blocked because earlier in her career, before she even became a law professor, she had been the legal director for NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League. And because of that, she was filibustered, not because of anything else in terms of her competence or ability.
So I know we're talking about two different things, appointments at Justice Department and the federal judiciary, which is highly stacked with Republican jurists, simply because the Republicans have controlled the executive branch for quite a few years, and mostly because in the Obama administration, they've succeeded in blocking so many of his nominations. Do you actually know the figures? My understanding is that it's pretty shocking how few people Obama's gotten through compared to how many George W. Bush got through.
The statistics are stunning. And if you go to a website that's done by the Alliance for Justice in Washington, D.C., they have all of those statistics on their website.
But just as a thumb sketch, do you have any recollection of what the numbers are, the ratio between how many people Bush got on the court and how few people Obama has managed to get on the court?
It's quite stunning, but I don't know the number.
So we've looked at that website that you just mentioned, and let me just read from it. During President Obama's time in office, current vacancies have risen by 58%. This trend stands in stark contrast to the comparable point in President Clinton and President Bush's second term, when vacancies had declined by 51% and 13%, respectively. Over 10% of all federal judgeships are vacant. Judicial vacancies are more than double what they were at this point in George W. Bush's second term. So just to turn to the Attorney General, Eric Holder, who has not, in the eyes of a lot of people, been particularly zealous, particularly on prosecuting malfeasance on Wall Street. After all, the entire economy was taken to the brink of a near-death experience. The taxpayers had to bail out Wall Street, make them whole. They're stronger than ever. And now, just in the last couple of days in hearings, the Attorney General made the extraordinary statement that some of these too big to fail banks were headed up by CEOs who were too big to jail. Because if you were to put them in jail, you would somehow hurt the overall economy. And I find that extraordinary that the chief law enforcement officer of the United States should be concerned about the economic implications of justice.
I find it deeply offensive. There's a very important principle in this country that no one is above the law. That includes the president. It includes the head of Fortune 500 companies. It includes you and Nate. When you look at how aggressive the federal government is, often in prosecuting people for very minor crimes, especially drug crimes, the idea that people who can cost others billions of dollars through fraud and through illegal activities would be above the law is just not acceptable. I have a client who was sentenced to 50 years to life for stealing $153 worth of videotapes. If somebody steals billions of dollars from the economy, surely they deserve to be punished, too, if they're violating the law.
Well, his Deputy Attorney General, under Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, of course, was a subject, not the subject, but he certainly didn't come across very well in a recent PBS Frontline special called The Untouchables, which posed the question, why hasn't there been any significant jail time for those on Wall Street who all but destroyed the economy and have been made whole while the economy, as you well know, is still languishing. And Lanny Brewer did not equip himself well in this documentary, and he quickly thereafter, it was on television, he resigned. Apparently he's going back to Wall Street. What are the chances of anybody replacing Eric Holder. Do you have any sense of whether there's going to be an opening at the Attorney General's position and whether somebody, a more zealous appointee, could take over?
There was a lot of speculation after President Obama's re-election about which cabinet officers would leave after the first term, since Hillary Clinton stepped down. Hilda Solis from Labor stepped down. Many thought that Eric Holder might resign. It hasn't happened yet. And if it happens, then it's anyone's guess as to who President Obama would pick to head the Justice Department.
Well, already Elizabeth Warren, who's becoming a very popular senator, and she's already expressed her absolute dismay at what Eric Holder said in regard to bankers being too big to jail. So the word is out there. A lot of people are wondering why the Justice Department has been so feckless.
I don't know why Eric Holder said that. I think it was an offensive statement. It cannot be that anybody is too big to jail in a country that believes that no one is above the law.
Well, Erwin Chemerinsky, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Erwin Chemerinsky, who's a founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California, Irvine School of Law, with a joint appointment in political science. Prior to joining UC Irvine, he taught law at Duke University and the University of Southern California. His books include Interpreting the Constitution, Constitutional Law, Principles and Policies, Enhancing Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, and his latest book is The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. He frequently argues cases before the highest courts, including the Supreme Court. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.